So let me just mention some of the key points you're going to be hearing about. So you may have heard of the fuzzy two-sphere. So I'll review some of that, and I'll describe a generalization of that to higher dimensions. And the interest in doing that is that these constructions are relevant to matrix theory, and more generally in studying matrix D-brain actions. And when these constructions are combined with matrix theories, they lead to a few interesting things, like gauge theories on non-commutative geometries, and also there are hints for the existence of gauge theories on non-associative geometries. And these two things are actually related in the context that we are going to be looking at. There's going to be non-abelian physics on one kind of geometry related to abelian physics on another kind of geometry. So there'll be non-abelian on the non-associative sphere, which will be related to abelian theory on a higher dimensional space. Most of what I say will work very simply in the case of even dimensional spheres, and some of it will generalize to odd dimensions, but there are also some peculiarities in that case. So a brief review of the physical setup. We are interested in studying, for example, the action of N D0 brains, which have among the fields living on the world line, we have 9 matrix scalars. We have an interaction term made out of commutators of this form. We have a kinetic term, plus some extra fermionic terms that are dictated by supersymmetry. And we have 9 scalars, one for each transverse direction. We have a particle moving in 10 dimensions, so there are 9 transverse dimensions. And sorry, what do I do with this?
You're blocking the point.
Oh, sorry, okay. Thank you. Right. So we have these 9 scalars, and so one for each transverse direction. So this is kind of the beginning of the fact that we're going to start seeing interesting geometries like non-commutative geometry associated with space, and that's because directions of space are being associated with matrices. And generalization of this zero brain action, we have a P brain action. Let's say we have N of them. We have UN gauge theory. We have a P plus 1 dimensional world volume action, Yang-Mills theory, interaction terms. Now we have transverse scalars corresponding to every direction transverse to the P brain. This action is particularly interesting because of things like the BFSS conjecture, which says that large N supersymmetric quantum mechanics with this gauge symmetry can give a non-perturbative formulation of string theory, in certain backgrounds. And this was the first example of gauge gravity duality, where stringy, including gravitational physics, was coming from a matrix gauge theory. And similar conjectures include the Mal-de-Sena ADS-CFT conjecture and the more recent PP wave conjecture. Now, quite generally in matrix models of this sort, and more generally in studying D-brains and various configurations of D-brains, intersecting or otherwise, it is interesting to look for non-trivial solutions of the D-brain action. So we want to know what kinds of solutions we have and what kind of physics is described by those solutions. And what is also interesting is to analyze fluctuations around these solutions. And the action for these fluctuations takes the form of field theories. And the kinds of field theories that we get generically, since we're using finite matrices, are not ordinary field theories because they have an intrinsic finiteness. So they are fuzzy geometries, which in some cases can be non-commutative, in others non-associative. But all these algebraic structures are derived from matrices. That's the content of this talk. There'll be matrix multiplication with a projection is non-associative. And then I'll describe what kind of projection is necessary in this context. Particularly interesting among these solutions are highly symmetric solutions, such as spheres, which, being very symmetric, in some cases can even provide supersymmetric vacua, as in the BMN matrix model. So here is an outline. I'll be talking about the fuzzy two-sphere, describing what it is, and some of its relevance to physical phenomena like brain polarization, which is when something like a zero brain can blow up into two brains. I'll describe how it is provides a very simple setting for non-commutative geometry and why it is an interesting way to study spheres, field theory on spheres, because it gives a finite realization of a continuous symmetry. I'll describe how this story generalizes to higher dimensional spheres, and as soon as you go beyond the two-sphere and onto the four-sphere, this non-associativity arises, and basically it's intimately connected to another geometrical phenomenon that arises here, which is that the matrices you use to describe higher fuzzy spheres tend to contain more degrees of freedom than required to describe the geometry of the sphere. And as a result, the full geometry is a higher dimensional geometry. And in order to get a projection to the required geometrical sphere degrees of freedom, one ends up finding a non-associative algebra, which is a deformation of the algebra of functions in the sphere. So I'll describe some of that. And so these two geometries are going to be related. There's going to be non-abelian physics going on here, which is related to abelian physics going on here. Among the non-abelian physics one sees on the non-associated geometry, in the large N limit, it's familiar physics. It's a physics of instantons. And then I will describe some things about the fuzzy odd-dimensional spheres. Some of these features carry over. We see hidden higher-dimensional geometries, but there are also some more intriguing things, which I will describe. So I start with a review of the fuzzy two-dimensional sphere, and so this is an example of a non-commutative space. So what do we mean by a non-commutative space? We have the space of functions in the manifold, maps from the manifold to real numbers or complex numbers, and they always have a natural product, which is the pointwise multiplication. And since we're just multiplying numbers, this is a commutative multiplication. And non-commutative manifolds are defined by deforming this algebra of functions to a non-commutative algebra, and a lot of geometry, topology, and field theory, perturbation theory, solitons, and so on, can be done in this more generalized context of non-commutative manifolds. So the simplest example of such a thing, we start with a classical sphere described by an equation like that with three variables. And since I said what we need here is to deform the algebra of functions, so let's recall what the algebra of functions looks like. You can have polynomial functions in the x's. In fact, symmetric traceless polynomials are all you need. By symmetric traceless, I mean if you had a tensor ta1 to an, xa1 up to an, this would be symmetric but also traceless. Namely, if I identify two things and sum, I should get a zero. That will be a way of classifying the set of independent functions on the sphere. The reason that we need this tracelessness condition is that, for example, if you just xi square, that's just one. So that's not a new function. It's trivially related to the identity function. So this is nice in that space of symmetric traceless polynomials is in one-to-one correspondence with representations of SO3. And they're familiar things. They're just spherical harmonics stated in Cartesian coordinates here. Now, this is a fact which holds true for any sphere, that the space of functions is going to be spanned by things corresponding to symmetric traceless polynomials in these variables. Now, we're going to deform this algebra to get a non-commutative algebra. So let's pick this deformation, which is a very familiar one. It's just the SU2 deformation. And I want something like an analog of the condition of a constant radius. So if we look at this, this is one condition we can set. I've chosen this way of writing it because it reminds you of the SU2 algebra. And we know that there is a, given this algebra, there is an n-dimensional representation where n is 2j plus 1 and the x is n by n matrices. So this you know, this algebra can be represented in n by n matrices. What is also true is that any of these n by n matrices can be written in terms of a sum of things involving either the identity matrix or products of x's, products of two x's, three x's, and so on. So there's a kind of isomorphism between this matrix algebra and the direct sum of representations of SO3, and this is an important equation which will have generalizations for higher groups.
So this commutator reflects Poisson brackets of functions on a sphere, because what you written just polynomials.
Yes.
Do not characterize sphere yet. On any manifold.
Yes.
Of the sphere, this will be the algebra of functions, because you could project everything to a sphere. If the thing is diffeomorphic to a sphere.
Okay.
But you need something else.
But you see, okay, that's right. Yeah, or anything. You know, if I start trying to put a metric on this and I want to preserve the SO3 symmetry, then I'm going to be uniquely forced into the sphere.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but just trace these polynomials, I think, do not define.
Yeah, okay. Okay, that's true.
Sphere.
Yeah.
Define any manifold of the topology of the sphere.
Yes, okay. You're right. You're right. So, that's right. Anything with the topology of the sphere. So, actually, yes, this is.
Yeah.
This is the only level at which I'm doing things at this point.
Yeah, but
okay.
Yeah, but then you
also yeah, then you would. Mm-hmm. And okay, so we had that algebra, and now if we rescale these x variables by root jj plus 1, this becomes the familiar sphere, unit sphere condition. And now the commutators are down by 1 over j when j is large. So n, which is 2j plus 1, when that becomes large, the x's or z's, excuse me, become commutative variables. So now we have all the ingredients that we need for this sphere. Commutative, three commutative variables obeying this unit radius condition. And what is also true from the fact that I mentioned before is that the algebra of matrices decomposes, and you can, maybe I've written it here, the n by n matrices can be classified into matrices which transform into specific representations of SO3, where these L's go from 0 up to 2j. There's a cutoff because there's only n square degrees of freedom here, so you have to make sure that the dimensions of these representations add up to the square of a number, and so that's part of the reason the two-sphere fits nicely into matrices, and that doesn't happen for higher spheres. So in the large n limit, then this 2j becomes infinite. You recover a space of fuzzy spherical harmonics, which approaches the space of ordinary spherical harmonics, because we have now every representation of SO3 with unit multiplicity. So when you add these up to recover n square, you only need one. So this is kind of a generalization of the familiar fact that any 2x2 matrix can be decomposed into a sum of things, any 2x2. Matrix I can write as some constant plus CA sigma A. So this is corresponds to the identity representation. This is the vector of SO3. But now for higher dimensional matrices, we have analogous equations where we add up to spins, which are higher, up to 2j. So, so I've said this here, that this is decomposing 2x2 matrices is a special case of this, and this holds because we can write the square of 2 as 3 plus 1, which are the dimensions of representations of SO3 in this manner. So this is a, you might ask, why did I choose this deformation? Well, it preserves SO3 symmetry, and if we want to do physics that preserves that symmetry, this is a good deformation to think about. Now, what do we do? What kind of physics do we do with this? A variety of different things. We can describe time-dependent membranes in matrix theory. That's what was one of the first applications of this in the context of matrix theory. You have the transverse scalars. You have some function. There's no A here. There's just one function. Multiplying these XAs, these are the matrices of the fuzzy sphere. And you can plug this into your equations of motion, find some time-dependent function which solves the equation of motion, and then find a kind of oscillating or some sort of time-dependent sphere, which was described by these people. More recent applications you have show up when you have zero branch in a background four-form field. Now you modify the action in addition to the commutator terms. You have some extra cubic term proportional to epsilon ABC, which is related to the field strength. Now, this modified action admits static solutions, which are these fuzzy sphere solutions. And so we have some equations of motion. We, I may not have written it exactly. Sorry, it should be something quadratic, I suppose. Anyway, so you have some equations of motion for that action. There was no mu in that case. And then those equations of motion are solved by phis, which are proportional to the x's. So you can go further and add a mass term. So with this cubic term and a mass term, you can also find static solutions, which are now supersymmetric. So these are relevant to the BMN matrix model. Now we also want to understand not just the solution, but also the fluctuations around the solutions. So suppose we had three of these phis, which were equated to x's, but now when we let them fluctuate, we're going to have some fluctuations. And then they're going to be scalars, which are transverse to those three that we picked in describing the two-brain. So these were zero on the solution. Now they're going to be matrices. So it's important to understand the configuration space of these fluctuations. And from what we said, the space of matrices maps the space of spherical harmonics. So these can be expected in the large n limit to become fields on a sphere. So by thinking about fluctuations around this solution, one can recover a field theory on a sphere. So part of the way this dictionary goes is I already said that the z's, which are the x's divided by an appropriate power of j, becomes coordinate in the sphere. Commutators with x's become derivatives. So you can see that they have some of the same properties as derivatives. For example, the Leibniz rule is obeyed by this action of a commutator. This invariant quadratic differential operator is related to a Laplacian, and traces become integrals. So in the large n limit, you recover something like a field theory on a sphere. So the trace becomes an integral. The original dt is still there. So we started with zero brains. We expanded around a solution, and we're recovering a 2 plus 1 dimensional theory, which is interpreted in terms of the world volume theory of a two-brain. So this was worked out in complete detail in some particular examples of solutions of matrix models in this paper.
So to write down the field theory, you take the large n limit.
Yes.
But only for the fluctuations. I mean, could you take the large n limit right at the beginning and just write the field theory and then solve the field theory?
You mean without picking any kind of solution, just yeah. Decompose the? I imagine you could, but I don't really know the physical interpretation of that. Somehow you're taking the SO9 symmetry without picking a solution. You want to break it to SO3 cross SO6, for example. So I'm not sure. I think in principle one should be able to do that. But the places where people have studied this is in the context of solutions. So what happens? So there are many surprises when you go to higher spheres.
What is different about a fuzzy sphere from a regular sphere? You told us how you do the calculation, but what makes the fuzzy sphere fuzzy?
Oh, so at finite n, mm-hmm. then the product is non-commutative because the commutators survive. Mm-hmm. So what makes it fuzzy is that it is being described by finitely many degrees of freedom. So n by n matrices. So the spherical harmonics have a cutoff up to 2j. So the cutoff and
that's the main difference.
That's the main difference.
Here, yeah. The main difference is that there's some kind of upper cutoff on the Fourier modes on the thing.
There's an upper cutoff and there's a consistent multiplication on that truncated space. Yeah. So this can be generalized to higher spheres and. Perhaps the first construction was given in 96 and applied in the context of matrix theory in 97 by Taylor and collaborators. So one of the things, well, that wasn't exactly made explicit in these papers, but which is one of the key things about the higher spheres, is that in the case of two-sphere, we found it necessary to give up this condition, that we needed to start thinking about algebras of functions where things don't commute anymore. And you might ask, would there ever be a reason to give up the associativity of multiplication? And the answer is yes, you do need to do that in the case of higher spheres. And this is related to kind of an interesting phenomenon, which is hidden extra dimensions. So you start off trying to describe what you think is a sphere, but turns out you're going to be describing a higher dimensional geometry. And it is necessary to do a projection to go back to the sphere. And this is what leads to non-associativity. So I'll be describing details of that now. So how do we, first of all, let me just recall how we do this, how we construct this fuzzy four sphere. So to do that, let me just recall the two sphere and describe it in a slightly different way. We have it, for the two sphere, we had coordinates XA, A going from 1 to 3. And then these were n by n matrices. And n was a parameter I could take to be large to recover classical geometry. But in the very simplest case, so the maximally quantum case, the x's, j was just half. The x's were 2 by 2 matrices. So they were sigmas, Pauli matrices. So, and of course, we wanted this condition. So sigma squares to 1. So it's something that commutes with every matrix. And that's the kind of thing we need if we want to write at finite n an equation of this form. Sum of x's square has to be something that can be set to a number. So it has to commute with things. So sigmas do that. And more generally, gamma matrices do that. So gamma, in the case of S4, we need S of 5 gamma matrices, because the xAs have a vector index, where A goes from 1 to 5, and so do the gammas. So in the maximally quantum form of the space-time coordinate is just a gamma matrix. And they obey these conditions you need for a sphere. And what are the gamma matrices? They are acting in a four-dimensional space. So they map. So we should think of them as a map from V to V, where this is a four-dimensional space, the spinner representation. But now we want to do a kind of large N version of this. We want a large N version of a gamma matrix. So the way we do that is we change the space it is acting on, and we change it to the N-fold tensor product of the basic one, little n. And then we have to specify how the gammas, so N-fold tensor product, and then symmetrize. So you only take symmetric things in that. So for example, if you had a V1 tensor V2, tensor other things, you would need in that space to have the V2 tensor V1. So there's a symmetrization that you need to do on the spinners. When you do that symmetrization, this representation becomes irreducible, an irreducible representation of SO5. And it has a dimension which goes like little n cube over 6, let's say. How do the gammas act? You just take the gammas to act the way you would usually let a Lie algebra or a symmetry act on a tensor product space. You act first on the first one, and then on the second, and then on the third, and so on. So if you take this action and that representation, you do recover this condition that sum of x a squares is just a number.
So that is the precise analog of how you go to higher j.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
In the regular.
That's right. So just. I'm sorry. Why is this called sim?
So one finds.
This? So, oh, why does it hold?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, okay, so that takes some calculation. I can explain how to do it.
So namely, it gets a cross term.
Yeah, so the cross term is also proportional to the identity.
Ah.
And that's, yeah, so you need to prove. It's something like that, yeah. OK, actually, yeah, the thing is that even the cross term, so I like to write the xa's as sort of r equals 1 to n, rho sub r of gamma a. So that's a compact way of writing this.
Yeah.
This says the gamma is acting successively on the first, second, and so on. So when you multiply xa with xa, you will get r not equal to s, rho sub r gamma a, rho sub s gamma a. You can easily prove that this commutes with SO5. Basically, all the indices are contracted. So it commutes with SO5. And because sim V tensor V is irreducible, if it commutes with SO5 and this is irreducible, it has to be just proportional to a number, and then you can calculate that number. So in fact, those cross terms are precisely the things that give you this n square. If you had only the diagonal terms, you would get something linear in n. Yes. So now, what is the algebra of the x's? It's going to look different from this SO3 case, because now you have new operators. And what are the new operators? They are just the kind, the things that you get by letting the commutators themselves act successively in the different factors of the tensor product. The cross terms don't give you, I mean, when you take a commutator, the cross terms vanish. So the only things that survive are these diagonal terms. And what appears here is the commutators. So here's the algebra. And now you rescale things to get a unit radius sphere by 1 over n again. And then in terms of the z's and z mu nu's, you're going to get an equation like this, but with a 1 over n. So that has two important implications. One is that it does become commutative in the large n limit. But also, it means that the z mu nu's become independent. They can't be recovered from commutators of the z's. Because they're independent, these are the extra degrees of freedom that are relevant in this problem. So the z mu's were coordinates on sphere. But in addition, we have extra coordinates in the classical geometry, which is related to this matrix algebra in the large n limit. So so that's the algebra. That's a hint that you're going to get a classical geometry. But to understand it better, we need to use the SO5 symmetry and understand how an arbitrary matrix decomposes into representations of SO5. Just like we had that equation, n square was L equals to, from L equals 0 to j of 2L plus 1, we need an analog of that equation to really understand what this space is. So it turns out that the kinds of representations you get are all the tensor representations of SO5. What are they? They are, so the gamma A itself transformed it had one index. So it transformed in the vector, which we can describe in like this. But now you get other operators like this, rho sub r1 gamma a1, rho sub r2 gamma a2, let's say r1 not equal to r2. I just mean here that you have pairs of gammas acting in separate of the tensor factors. Now this transform, it's symmetric, so it transforms in something like this. And in fact, it transforms in the symmetric traceless. Because if I did take a trace, if I identified these two and summed, I would get back something proportional to the identity. So I wouldn't get a new function. So for the purposes of classifying the functions, classifying the matrices, we have exactly one copy of this, one copy of the symmetric traceless, one copy of the antisymmetric, and so on. So for each such representation, we can write down some corresponding operator. And the result is that this n by n matrix algebra can be decomposed in a one-to-one manner into representations of SO5, which are these tensor representations, which can be described by a Young tableau, where you have symmetrization along here, anti-symmetrization here, and it is characterized by two numbers. So, and again, one checks that n square is equal to the sum of dimensions of these representations with some cutoff. Yeah. So the cutoff depends on little n, because you see, for example, with these operators, since there are only n copies of V, I can't generalize this beyond having more than n copies of gamma. So there is a cutoff. So we have a cutoff space of SO5 representations, the kind of thing we would expect for a fuzzy sphere, except that this spectrum of representations is too big. It contains the symmetric traceless, which corresponds to these guys with no second row, but it also contains extra representations, these antisymmetric representations. So you say, OK, but I have all the representations I need for a sphere. And in fact, I have them with a correct multiplicity. I have them appearing once, just like I have in the spherical harmonics of the sphere. So because the multiplicity is correct, we can define a projection. So any matrix, we can decompose it using that equation I described before into specific representations of SO5. And we just project it and keep the symmetric ones. That will help us define an algebra, which will be a kind of deform algebra of functions on a sphere.
Does that naturally come out of, well, if you try to form one of these spheres from a collection of n d0 rings,
mm-hmm.
Does that condition naturally come out?
it doesn't naturally, I mean, what you have is the full matrix algebra. But if you want to interpret it in terms of physics on the sphere, then in a sense it's natural.
Well, but then you've got the configurations that don't obey that.
Yeah, that's right. So this will lead to the statement that the full physics is non-abelian physics. So these extra variables from the point of view of the sphere, okay, I'll get to that. Maybe I'll try to answer that again slightly later. But let me, for now, pause to describe some properties of this product, which is that if you have this matrix product and you multiply, you have this subspace, so you have symmetric things, but you multiply, you can get both symmetric and anti-symmetric. So this subspace is not closed under multiplication. So you can, however, you can define a modified product by just multiplying and then projecting. That will give me some product. It's the only product in town for this subspace. And what we can do is observe that this is non-associative because it's not matrix multiplication. It's a projected matrix multiplication. It's non-associative, but what one can show using these explicit operators that the non-associativity vanishes at large n. So it approaches the ordinary algebra, commutative associative algebra in the large n limit. But at finite n, it is forced to be non-associative. One can also show that even at finite n, it has a nice action of SO5. So these two index anti-symmetric things act as like differential operators. So they have they act on the product the way usual derivatives would act on the product. So this property continues to hold at finite n. So that kind of is another indication that this is a good product to be thinking about. Yes?
I think I'm probably missing something out
of okay.
Why can't you project first and then multiply and then you have an associative?
You project first, you get a subspace.
Right.
If you multiply those, you get outside the space.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
So now a simple way to see that non-associative products can come about from matrices, if you just take this, define A star B to be AB plus BA, you can check that this is not true. A star, B star, C is not the thing. What I am doing is not exactly just symmetrizing the product. I'm doing a projection. So, but just to let you say a simple way to see that you can get non-associativity is to do this exercise. And the particular non-associative algebra I described is kind of an interesting one. I already said that at large n it becomes associative. But you might ask, what is the leading large n correction? So the product is commutative. Oh, I forgot to say that. The product is actually commutative because I threw out everything anti-symmetric. So in particular, I threw out the commutators. So it's a commutative but non-associative product. And it was necessary to throw out the anti-symmetric stuff because these transform in SO5 representations which don't belong on the sphere. So you get a commutative but non-associative. And if you go to the leading large n limit, you have structure constant which actually make this algebra a Jordan algebra. So the reason for mentioning all this is that it's not an arbitrary non-associative.
What is the problem?
Okay, Jordan algebra is defined as something which obeys this condition. And this is somewhat an ugly looking thing. Anything which is any product which is AB plus BA will obey this thing. Now, in the leading large n approximation, that product I define does become just AB plus BA. But at finite n, it's not equal to that.
It's not AB plus BA.
It's not AB plus BA. The reason it's not AB plus BA is the following. The reason it's not AB plus BA is that you take symmetric things. Let's say I multiply this with this, and then I'm going to get this kind of anti-symmetric thing and this. And then I project out the anti-symmetric. So at this level, it looks like it's just the it's just AB plus BA. However, if I took something else more complicated, like the following, I took something like this, okay, then I would have, among the things I get, I will get the maximal symmetric guy, but I will also get things like this. This appears symmetrically in the product, but it is an anti-symmetric representation. So I do have to throw it out. Therefore, the product is not the symmetrization. However, this is a kind of a sub-leading in the large n. That's why in the leading large n correction, you get a Jordan algebra. OK, so there is this funny projection we have to live with. But then you say, what if I didn't project? what is the geometry of that full matrix algebra? And it's kind of an interesting matrix algebra. It has an interesting spectrum of SO5 harmonics. In a sense, it's a generalization of the sphere. Just like the sphere had all SO3 harmonics, all allowed representations of SO3 with unit multiplicity, this has all allowed representations of SO5 with unit multiplicity. So what is there such a classical space? The answer is yes. There is a coset, SO5 mod U2. So like the sphere, it's also a coset, SO5 mod SO4, but it's not the same coset that the S4 is. Now, whenever you have a chain of subgroups like that, SO5 containing SO4 containing U2, so U2 is relevant to our matrix algebra here, and you look at this coset, SO5 mod U2, you can form a fiber bundle where this thing is a bundle over SO5 mod SO4, in this case S4, and the fiber is just this mod this. Using some isomorphisms in classical groups, you can see that this is actually just S2. So the full space is an S2 fiber on top of the S4. And at finite n, everything is fuzzy, because we only recover classical geometry at large n. So at finite n, we have a fuzzy S2 over an S4.
But how do you get SO5? SO5 group manifold?
Oh, because that has the SO5 decomposition of that contains pairs of representations of SO5. There's left and right multiplication. So the kind of harmonics of SO5 that appear in that group manifold are pairs of representations of SO5. So here I just have one representation, a list of representations of SO5. Yes?
I thought you started off wanting to define a fuzzy four-sphere.
That's correct.
So it looks like you...
Looks like maybe I didn't.
You didn't.
So that's why I brought up this bundle, and now I'm going to interpret this bundle. Okay. So,
but were the earlier definitions of fuzzy four spheres?
I'm just developing that same old kind of elaborating on what the full geometry of that is. Yeah. So now to interpret this, we may ask. So we have. Let's kind of see this bundle structure and try to see if we can understand it at finite n. So what happens at finite n is that the fuzzy S2 fiber. This S2 fiber is a fuzzy S2. What that means concretely, fuzzy S2 was 2J representation, 2J matrices. So the way to see that is, so these Zs are the coordinates on the S4. So let's fix them such that we are at the north pole. So we fix a point. And we look at the states. So you see, what are the Zs? We are working in this matrix algebra, sim V tensor N. And so the ZAs are some operators which map Rn to Rn at finite n. And we can ask what states in this space fix are such that the expectation values of the Zs are the following. So that's a way of going to the north pole of that sphere. And what you find is that there are finitely many of them. In fact, there are little n plus 1 of them. And furthermore, you find that these anti-symmetric guys, these extra anti-symmetric guys, the ZIJs, there is a set of three independent ones of them, which transform these n states among each other. And this set of three operators form an SU2 algebra. So you wanted to see a fuzzy S2, these are the generators of that fuzzy S2. But you see there are also ZIJs, which are related to commutators of Xi with Xj. Now, so if you're familiar with some of the things one does in matrix theory, one often converts sort of a matrix Debrin, higher matrix Debrin action to a lower dimensional one by taking Fij to Xi commutator Xj. So when you see Xi commutator Xj, you should interpret it from the point of view of the higher dimensional brain as a field strength. So these Zij variables are related to a field strength in the dual four-brain field theory. So the simplest setup is a zero-brain, four-brain bound state. And the fact that we are getting many states at the north pole of the sphere means that we are describing a non-abelian physics. And you look at these ZIJs, they give you what ought to be field strengths for the world volume theory of that four-brain. And you can calculate many properties of it. You know what's the rank of that gauge group. you know, what's the instanton number? So these are self-dual fields. They have an instanton number. And in fact, this can be checked independently because the zero-brain, four-brain system is also related to a one-brain, five-brain intersection system. And in that case, Myers and collaborators have studied the same system from the dual five-brain point of view. And they have found that in order to describe this same system, which you can describe either from the one-brain point of view using fuzzy four spheres, you can also describe it from the five-brain point of view using a spherically symmetric instanton, which has field strengths, which at the North Pole look like the one that I just described. So yes, it is related to the sphere, but it's related to non-abelian physics on the sphere. Okay. Okay, X. Okay, I was a little sloppy between Zij and Xij. Okay, so Xij is
the algebra of functions which you described. The algebra of functions on what?
On the higher dimensional space, S of 5 mod U2.
S of 5 mod U2, and this is a bundle over
S4 with an S2 fiber. But you see, the S2 fiber, what is a fuzzy S2? There are two ways of thinking about fuzzy S2. When you think about fuzzy S2, you have n by n matrices.
So this bundle is some sort of instanton over S4.
That's correct. That's
so
correct.
Describing the algebra of functions from the instanton over. It's not instanton, but the associated bundle to instanton.
I suppose it is. Oh, well, you see, there are two ways of thinking about the bundle. Okay, there's something non-trivial here. There are two ways of thinking about the bundle, and that comes from the fact that the fuzzy S2 is related to, so when you do fuzzy S2, there's an SO3 or SU2 symmetry, but once you expand an arbitrary n by n matrix in terms of products of x's, what do you have here? You have the basis of the Lie algebra of un, or u2j plus 1. So the physics indicates that this is the relevant group to be thinking about because we can calculate the four-brain charges and show that it's related to this. So this non-trivial fact that fuzzy S2, the algebra of functions, in fact, this is the first appearance of the fuzzy S2, was as an approximation to U infinity. So that's what we are going back and using now, that this S2 in the geometry on top of S4 can be interpreted in terms of a UN set of degrees of freedom on top of the S4. Okay, so let me continue. So that was one description, non-abelian theory on a non-associative S4. An alternative and equivalent description of the same system is suggested by the standard analysis of matrix fluctuations. Standard analysis says you have Zi's and Zij's. These are functions on SO5 mod U2. And if I have a transverse matrix, its fluctuations is going to be a function on this higher dimensional space. So another way of describing the same physics should be just some theory on this SO5 mod U2. And it's going to be an abelian theory, because once you fix the expectation values of both the Zi's and Zij's, you don't get a multiplicity of states like we got if you only fix the Zi's. You get just one state. And so it's an abelian theory on this higher dimensional manifold. And if you're going to be able to write an action for such a thing, these Xi's and Xij's better be differential operators. So just like we saw in the fuzzy two-sphere case, commutators with Xi's were derivatives. So now commutators with Xi's and Xij's must be derivatives where you have some derivatives with respect to both the Z's and the Zij's. And you can indeed write down such derivatives which are consistent with the algebra obeyed by the Xi's and the Xij's. And you can further use these derivatives to write down actions, which has also been done. So the suggestion here, to some extent conjecture, is that there is a non-abelian theory living on a non-associative four-sphere, which in the large n limit just becomes an ordinary non-abelian theory living on a classical four-sphere. But that's equivalent to an abelian theory, an abelian but non-commutative gauge theory living on this higher dimensional coset. So this abelian description can sort of be worked out directly from the matrix theory, but this theory on the non-associative sphere remains to be worked out.
Sorry, which one was it really?
The theory living on the higher dimensional manifold, yes. Kind of plausible, right? Yeah. Sort of you put more degrees of freedom into the geometry and less into non-abelianness. So I'm not going to have time to describe this in too much detail, but this story works for any higher sphere, S2k, S4, S6, S8, and so on. So what works? There's always, you can always decompose the algebra of the matrices in terms of harmonics of the higher SO group. You can calculate how many zero brains are involved. You can calculate how many six brains are involved. This calculation is precisely this kind of calculation of looking at the North Pole and finding how many states are left over. This tells you how many extra brains you have. So you can say something about the number of zero brains and six brains, by the way, without using anything about D-brain actions, just from the geometry of the matrix algebra. So that works for SO, S6, and S8, and so on. And there's always a higher dimensional coset involved. For example, it's always SO 2k plus 1 mod uk. In the case of SO 9 or S8, we have this as the base space, SO 9 mod u4 as the total space. And then you get some higher dimensional fiber, which, like the fuzzy two-sphere, has the property that it can be mapped in a one-to-one manner onto matrices. So therefore, you can interpret it in terms of non-abelian physics on a sphere. So that now higher odd spheres are a little more intricate. So just slightly more, though. What happens is we want to imitate the construction we had for the fuzzy even spheres. So we want to associate operators to Xi's, and we want to find equations like this. This is some constant. And we want to associate this with, in the simplest case, gamma matrices, just to generalize the simplest thing we know, the case of the evens here. But one thing about the gamma matrices, so let's say the simplest case is S3 with symmetry SO4. Now, the gamma matrices, well, first of all, there are two spinners. There's S plus, S minus, two chiralities. So, and the gamma matrix acts from V plus to V minus. So previously, we had gamma from V to V. So if we want to get something like V to V, our V has to be a direct sum of things. So our matrix is, there's going to be a V plus here and a V minus here. And the gamma matrices are going to be off diagonal. And the V plus and the V minus themselves together combine into a single V. So these are ereps of SO4. This is a single erep of SO5. But it's just a direct sum. Now, how do we build a finite end generalization? So we want some analog of these gamma matrices where the matrices are becoming large. So we want to have an index n here and an index here, n here. And we want to be able to take n large. And we want to be able to do that in such a way that sum of xi squared continues to be a constant. And there is a construction that works. It is the following. What is v plus to the n? You take sim v to the n, where v is that direct sum. In that space, there are going to be many different kinds of representations, one where they are all v pluses, one where they are all v minuses, and then various other ways of decomposing it. You pick the one. In that space, you project to the one, to the subspace, where you have n plus 1 over 2 v pluses and n minus 1 over 2 v minuses. That you call vn plus. Okay? It's not too hard to explain why. So that you call vn plus, and then you call vn minus the one where you have fixed this to be minus and this plus. The reason this has to be the case is just that you want these xi's to be some non-trivial operators. And these xi's, they are obtained from the action of gammas on each successive factor in the tensor product. So if I have a bunch of V pluses, V pluses, V pluses, and a bunch of V minuses, if I had n plus 1 over 2 of them, and n minus 1 over 2 of these others, when a gamma acts here, it can take a V plus to a V minus, and as a result, there will be a space where I have exactly n minus 1 over 2 of these, and n plus 1 over 2 of these. If the difference between the pluses and minuses was more than that, when you act with a gamma, you can't go from one to the next. So you want the xi to be a non-trivial operator. That's why this forces you to choose this. And fortunately, when you make this choice, this equation continues to be true. So you recover the fact that you have an equation defining a sphere. So as in the previous cases, the full matrix algebra contains too much. It's not just the space of functions on a sphere. So what is it? And in particular, we have to take into account this 2x2 block structure, which continues to survive even at large n. So what you get, if you just work out the decomposition under SO4 of these various blocks, here you get a space of functions, space of functions on SO4 mod U1 cross U1. So the space of algebra of functions on this. Likewise here, you also get a space of functions on SO4 mod U1 cross U1. But in the off-diagonal parts, you get not a space of functions, but a space of sections of a bundle on this space. So the off-diagonal things are some things that transform non-trivially under the geometry of that space. And this kind of story works for higher odd spheres. In the case of a 5-sphere, the relevant geometry is U2 cross U1, and so on. And the reason this is very odd is that this thing doesn't seem to be a bundle over S4, over the relevant sphere, like in the previous case. The reason you can't write down such a bundle structure is that this SO5, you would have wanted to write it as a something like that. So, however, you can't because the fiber, which would have been SO5 mod U2 cross U1, doesn't make sense because this is not a subgroup of this one. So you don't have such a bundle structure. So this is very mysterious. What does this physics could possibly have to do with brains on spheres at all? You can write an alternative bundle structure, which is the following. So you do pick something where you can write a bundle structure like that. And then the fiber is SO4 mod U2, which is just S2. So, okay, this is a little speculative, but perhaps this bundle structure might be useful to unravel the physics of this, the D-brain physics of this, because this kind of coset has come up in connection with S5, well, in fact, more precisely in connection with RP5, which is S5 mod Z2. And actually, the space of, I said we had these off-diagonal things, the xi's. These were the off-diagonal things. So they are not contained in the space of functions here. So this only contains the space of functions on RP5. So also the matrix algebra suggests RP5. And then there was this paper of Witten on baryons and brains in ADS, where he observes that if you look at a 3-brain wrapping some S3 mod Z2 in this space, the space of collective coordinates of that space is this coset, because the space that the group that stabilizes an S3 is something involves an SO4 and a transverse SO2. So the true physics of this fuzzy 5-sphere might be something more complicated, where you have kind of non-abelian physics on the space of collective coordinates of an extended object in S5. So whereas you started with trying to construct a fuzzy S5, you can't construct everything you would want to if you want to stay compatible with the symmetries. And it may be that this is the kind of thing you are constructing. And so just conclusions. But that's kind of conjecture. It would be very nice to really understand what's the physics of that 5-sphere. In fact, the original motivation was to try to understand the transverse 5-brain problem of matrix theory, but it's not clear that this will be related. But so the summary is that if you study extended objects, how to build extended objects from zero brains in string theory, you learn many things: non-commutative geometry, non-associative geometry, hidden extra dimensions, and this may be relevant to various kinds of problems in deep brain physics. For example, giant gravitons, where sometimes we believe gravitons can expand into three spheres or five spheres. So it is possible that these kinds of constructions might be useful to me in making that explicit. And just one thing that I think is particularly interesting, so I have only said a few words about this non-associative theory, but I think it'll be interesting to develop it for the following reason. One has, you know, the old story, let's deform space-time, make it non-commutative, learn something about quantum physics or quantum gravity. So you do that, and then you find this Briggs-Lorentz invariance. So here's the idea. You just set it to zero, and then you break associativity with a scalar parameter, because all the indices are absorbed by everything else. So if one can develop such a non-associative theory, it will have a deformation parameter, which will be just a scalar. In my case, it was here. In the fuzzy S4 case, this was 1 over n. That's all it could be, because n was the deformation parameter. So this would be a very interesting object to study, field theory on this thing, or gauge theory on this thing, as a candidate for physics involving short distances. Another open question is whether there's any relation between the odd spheres and the quantum Hall effect, because the fuzzy S4 is the mathematics is kind of identical to what people do in the 4D quantum Hall effect. And a very interesting question is whether there might be some sort of 3D quantum Hall effect related to the fuzzy 3-sphere. Thank you.
All these algebras are vacuum of matrix theory?
That's not known to be true. Only the fuzzy 2-sphere is a vacuum.
You can substitute
this in the equation. Yes, you certainly can. In fact, any even sphere solves a very simple matrix action. Commutator square term with a tachyonic mass term. Well, just put a mass term, x mu square, but put the wrong sign, and look at the equations of motion for that. That will be solved by any higher dimensional even sphere.
Well, ordinary 2-sphere in the sum is positive mass term,
right? With positive mass term and this epsilon term, So kind of, find all the right physical context for all the spheres is an interesting open problem. Yeah, so and the odd sphere, you can write down some actions which would be solved. Sorry, go on.
Would they solve the BMM matrix model, or it doesn't have enough dimensions?
I think potentially you have enough dimensions for the 4-sphere, but I think the sign of the mass is not right. I think the mass is of the right kind in that case. So it's a correct sign mass term. Interestingly, there's another matrix model, the OSP-132 matrix model proposed by Lee Smolin. It has fields with both negative, fields transforming in the vector like we need here of SO9 with the wrong sign mass term. So it has one such term, one such field, and another such field with the right sign mass term. And people have found these fuzzy 6 and 8 sphere, actually the 8 sphere, as a solution of such a matrix model. That's a good question. Go on.
Well, in open string theory, I guess you have only non-commutivity.
Yes.
In closed string theory, you have open non-associativity.
Yeah, but the way it's coming about here, somehow you are doing the open string product with a projection. So I don't really know. There should be such a construction, I would hope.
In closed string theory, you wouldn't stop at associativity right away.
If there are other things, yes. Mm-hmm.
That doesn't come up. I mean,
I have only seen this kind of.
I mean, all your spheres except the 2-sphere are
non-associative.
Commutative, but non-associative.
That's right.
Other higher associators or whatever they're called as zero.
I haven't really checked that. Whether these higher associators are zero. That's, I mean, you know, there is a concrete definition of the product. I've checked that it's non-associative. I haven't really checked if these other properties are. Yes?
Describe the three-sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Could you, you want to start with SO4.
Yes.
So could you use the fact that that's closely related to SU2 plus SU2 and then try to take two copies of your, you know, two-sphere description and does that...
Okay. Actually, that in a sense is not how I started, but kind of I end up looking at things related to that, because the hidden high-dimensional geometry that shows up after you're done with things in this case turns out to be, so that this space of matrices sitting here becomes a commutative algebra in the large n limit, which coincides with a space of functions on this space, which is SU2 cross SU2 mod U1 cross U1, which is S2 cross S2. So in some sense, there is a relation between that S3 and this thing. But even here, there's the puzzle that I don't know a simple geometrical relation between this and S3. Like there was a bundle structure in the fuzzy S4 case. But here, I don't really know. So I suspect that you know, the interpretation of this S2 cross S2 might be, or this SO4 mod U1 cross U1 might be as the space of collective coordinates of a brain sitting inside S3, because there's the SO4, and then if you pick a one brain, say, it'll have an SO2 rotation, and there's a transverse SO2, so the space of collective coordinates might end up being this. So somehow it's, in all these odd cases, it seems that it's not too clear how to relate it to a field theory on that S3. Yes?
Are there any things you can learn by looking at any other angles, topologies, or I know people have built things like tubes and I think higher dimensional tori out of D brains using the Myers type of stuff.
Yes?
Is there anything you can learn from that relating to the.
To the extent that I've talked to people who have worked on this, they haven't found sort of, you know, for example, the super tubes people have studied where there's an extra, there's a cylinder, S1 cross R. So if you, I asked some people, maybe David Mateos, who's worked on this, whether the S1 can be generalized to an S3. And somehow, and they are studying from a completely different point of view, just what would be the higher world brain action that would be describing such a thing. And they don't find sort of an S3 generalization of that. So I don't know, maybe one should really be looking for S3 mod Z2, because the only classical geometry that appears is an S3 mod Z2. So there, I mean, it remains to be found. I think there are lots of things that haven't been explored.